I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today and recognise their continuing connection to lands, waters and communities. We pay our respects to elders past and present.
The reality is you're only going to keep earning the right to have very high returns on capital if you look after all your stakeholders. If you deliver high returns at the expense of your customers, your suppliers, your employees, the environment, or the society more broadly, you'll get found out. You'll get found out by social media, you'll get found out by asset owners and focus there is today in global markets. So we've always felt our search for future quality and the search for high ESG attributes are absolutely the same thing.
Hello and welcome to Take Stock, a podcast by Future Generation. In this series, we get a backstage pass into the minds of leading fund managers and work out how and why they make the stock choices they do. I'm Caroline Gurney, the CEO of Future Generation. We're Australia's first listed investment company to deliver both social and investment returns by harnessing the generosity of our leading fund managers. So far, we've donated more than $75 million to not-for-profits that improve the lives of young Australians. And we can do this because of people like William Lowe from Nikko Asset Management. They charge zero performance and management fees for managing future generations' money. That means we can donate 1% of our assets to Australian charities. So Will is here with me in the studio today, all the way from Edinburgh. He's going to be my second Take Stock guest in a row who's been from Edinburgh. Anyway, I'm not quite sure what's going on, but we're very lucky to have them. So Will, welcome.
Well, thank you. Delighted to be here. Sydney has to be said one of my favourite places in the world.
Oh, I love
and
to hear that.
Nothing to do with the fact just it's slightly better weather at this time of year.
But you've had a real well-worn trip, though, from what you were saying. You've been to quite a few continents.
Indeed I have. But hey, that's part of the job and just seeing clients in various corners of the region, which has been good fun.
So I really want to start with artificial intelligence. I mean, it's really what everybody's talking about. There's so much hype at the moment. I mean, for me, it's still very much in its infancy, but the valuations are staggering. So is this sector going to be another bubble, or do you think that investors are still underestimating AI?
I think they're still underestimating AI, and there's a key reason why it doesn't look like just another bubble. Yes, there's a level of expectation now being built into share prices, but there's real tangible evidence actually with the early stages of a major adoption wave, which is effectively an arms race for the big technology companies to adopt this new technology. If they don't, they're probably going to die. And more importantly, you've got a bunch of other governments joining in, wanting to be involved in AI and not outsource that, dare I say it, to the US necessarily. Then finally, unfortunately, it's a literal arms race in certain corners of the world as well. So, you know, very much AI is here to stay. I would add the differences are a little bit different this time as well, in that it's funded by companies who can afford to spend on it. And they're getting real tangible benefits already. So this is not dream chasing hype bubbles, which can be seen in the past. It's certainly something a bit different.
So you, Will, you talked about sort of the arms race. And importantly, I think, you know, as you said, companies now can afford to really go into artificial intelligence. So in terms of your fund, how exposed are you to artificial intelligence? And how can Australian investors actually get access to it more?
We're exposed through a few holdings, of which obviously the largest would be NVIDIA. But we also own a range of other names that are either directly or indirectly exposed, from Synopsys, the software design company, or indeed Broadcom, which is another semiconductor company, to TSMC. So there's a range of ways of playing AI, which you think is actually a great place and exactly what we look for with our philosophy.
And what proportion of your fund would artificial intelligence be? Like, what else are you exposed to?
We're exposed to many things that far beyond just artificial intelligence. So again, you know, for example, Microsoft is a part of what Microsoft does, but it's not the whole thing it does in any shape or form. So many companies are either directly benefiting to some degree from AI, or more importantly, some of them are using it to implement in their business to make it even better, more defensible, with a deeper and wider moat, where I would suggest Meta is a good example of that. So defining exactly which stocks and what proportion of the portfolio is AI related, it, I think, is maybe a tough question. The better question might be, have you got the right businesses to grow, compound up in a world where it's harder to deliver growth because central banks are trying to discourage it? And if you've got independent growth, which AI can be a good part, actually, you've got something differentiated.
And do you have healthcare and sort of the energy in your portfolio?
We don't necessarily have energy, but we've also got healthcare. So it's, again, it's all about businesses that are going to do well in the future. And to be fair, some of the healthcare names that we've owned had a tough time last year because essentially they had overhang of inventory following the burst of spending post-COVID, has had an echo of inventory build and therefore less demand. And they've been ignored by investors, partly because they've had frustratingly lack of growth. But I think that's now beginning to happen more and be evident to actually these great businesses that have always grown, compounded up, are normalising some of their orders and growth. And really there's a bit of a left behind now. Companies like Danaher or Biotechne or Abbott, we own our portfolios, we think are all really good plays on that front.
So I think, I know that investors are actually looking at a price rate cut, that, you know, that's what everybody would really like. But a lot of people are actually saying that's not going to happen because of, you know, inflation needs to be more under control. You've got Jamie Dimon. We've had Phil Lowe, who is the former governor of the Reserve Bank in Australia. And he just agreed to be our Future Generation Australia chair. And they're saying that rates might still need to go up. You know, what are you expecting from interest rates and inflation?
We don't pretend we're the big bond for forecasters, we're equity stock pickers. But what we would observe would be there's a bit of a yin and yang there. There's some disinflationary forces are pretty clear from supply chains, inventory build, some weaker growth, and indeed technology at one side. But actually, you've also got a cycle this time very different. You've got a cycle where actually there's not been mass layoffs. Fully employed, still got wage inflation, commodities bottoming and such energy now picking up. So you've got to, it's difficult to predict exactly what the path of inflation is. And I guess our best guess would be at this stage of the cycle, probably continue to assume higher for longer would be the norm until proven otherwise.
Nikko is obviously a Japanese asset manager, and the most legendary stock picker of all, Warren Buffett, has been very bullish on Japan in recent years. Do you have a view on Japan?
Not a strict view in Japan, other than it's easy to observe there's obviously a bit of a change in policy. And also there's the ongoing structural change in Japan where companies, in terms of the degree to which they've looked after shareholders as compared to other stakeholders, has probably been less focused on stakeholders, would be a polite way of putting it. And but gradually that is changing. So there's generally an improvement in the return on capital. But the reason I highlight, you know, in terms of what it means for the type of companies we pick, you know, we're really focused on companies that have to be attaining and sustaining very high returns on capital over the long term. And many of the companies in Japan are starting from very low returns of capital to getting slightly better, which means they don't necessarily meet the key philosophy that we're looking for.
So let's turn to China. Its economic recovery has disappointed. Do you think that we're going to see lower but more sustainable growth from China? What's your view there?
Sustainable is a harder one to predict. The lower, the answer would be yes. I think the challenge that China's got, it feels like the debt deflationary bind that many other economies have gone through is following that roadmap we've seen elsewhere, of which Japan has been the biggest one we'd highlight. We've been thinking that for a while, and hence it's very difficult to see significant growth. There will be attempts to liquefy, no doubt at the margin, maybe more fiscal expense to try and engender growth and let that little bubble, or particularly large bubble, deflate rather slowly, which is exactly the same roadmap, dare I say it, we've seen in almost every other developed economy. And in a country where you need to ensure everyone is always employed or fed, I would suggest even more likely that you'll let it go down smoothly. So subdued growth would be the norm, would be my expectation.
I haven't heard that one before, subdued growth. I like that.
I'm trying to be polite in terms of listeners.
So I'm really fascinated how you actually choose a stock. So how do you go about choosing a stock?
There's two things. One is you want to know exactly what type of company you look for. So I mentioned previously that attain and sustain high returns on capital. So the path of returns is really important for us, combined with some future quality pillars, strong management, franchise, balance sheet, and a sensible valuation. So you start with the quality principles, you focus with some really good research team, focus trying to find those ideas around the world. And then to find them into the portfolios is just as important. Lots of great ideas, but how do you find the best? How do you weight them properly? So you could have a very well-designed process that embraces team, culture, and an organised way of ranking, comparing them to make sure only the best ideas get into the portfolio, which is really what we've been doing for the last 13 years.
So you run a high conviction fund, roughly 40 to 60 stocks. Would you mind talking through one stock that you've picked and the process behind that and why you believe it's going to be there for the long term?
Okay, yes. Yeah, so between 40 and 50, low 40s consistently over the last decade and longer. Biggest current active weight in our portfolios is the way we would measure it would be Netflix. And it's a great example of what we really look for. Companies that go on a unique journey of improvement. And for example, Netflix changing its pricing model last year, in short, lent to more net revenue growth due to the change in subscribers' number paying, add in the advertising model, and you end up with a franchise that is the leading streamer, the best content, more profitable, and in an industry where every one of its competitors are struggling to make any money at all. So you're basically the stronger is getting stronger and clearly be the long-term winner. And it took a while, I think, for investors to wake up to that reality that Netflix had become a much better and higher growth animal than it was before.
And it was also quite controversial at the time in terms of their pricing strategy. I remember reading a lot about it. But when they did, I mean, obviously, as you say, it's had a great result for them.
But I think you're spot on. Controversy is great. Because at the end of the day, the best ideas have always got wrinkles on them. The best companies, if they look perfect and everybody can enunciate exactly why a company is brilliant, the chances are everyone's already exposed to it. And to be honest, if you want to make a very high return, you ideally need a lot of buyers who need to change their mind. And controversy is sometimes a good starting point.
With a high conviction fund, you know, if you pick correctly, you can definitely hit it out of the ballpark. But the opposite is also true. How risky is a concentrated approach? And what do you do to mitigate that risk?
We've got 40 holdings.
And is that a lot?
No, I don't think that's a lot at all. In terms of sufficient to give you and really capture the very key philosophy, but in a diversified way. You know, we've got a range of companies that we're invested across geographies and sectors. So we're not dependent on just one individual gamble factor, whatever you want to call it. You're getting our ability as a team to pick a range of ideas that meet our philosophy. And 40 stocks we found historically very much can deliver that and deliver quite significant high returns over the long term.
And you have a lot of turnover in your team and in your portfolio. How do you know when to sell? You know, what are the things you look for and you see, and then you decide to actually sell that particular company?
Well, first of all, in terms of, there's no change in teams. That's an easy one in terms of change. But when it comes to the portfolio, we do embrace the fact, two things. Over time of owning great companies, you don't have everyone right. You will make mistakes in a 40-stock portfolio, whatever number you've got. You need to embrace that fact. And actually, when you made a mistake, admit it as early as you can so you can redeploy in something better. So that's one of the things that we do as a team and why we've got what we call our specific ranking tool to help identify either companies that were wrong to begin with or indeed have performed so well there's actually less upside. And they're the things that really drive what we do and changes in the portfolio, which has been round about 30% per annum over the last 5 years or so or longer. So proportionate turnover to keep redeploying. And I would suggest in a world where valuations and in terms of key drivers are changing all the time.
You're known for your future quality investing philosophy. What does that mean in practical terms? Is it something that an everyday investor could do?
Well, no, an everyday investor can buy historical quality. We live in a world where data and computing power is pretty easy to come by. So knowing who were the great companies of the past anybody could do, to be honest. But what we challenge ourselves with, we get excited in terms of what we do, is trying to work out which companies in 5 years' time or longer will still be great, or even better, have gone a journey of improvement to become great companies. That's where the higher returns are, and that's what is harder to replicate if you don't have the right philosophy, focus, and great talent working together as a team. To me, they're the essential ingredients. If others can do that, or individually, well, great. But that's what we've delivered, and exactly why, you know, your fund, such as ours, embraces what we provide for the overall strategy. So.
I know you're not involved in this, but obviously you launched a global green bond fund late last year. How does ESG figure in your process?
It's relatively simple. If we want to buy a great franchise, you know, with a great management team that earns very high returns on capital, the reality is that you're only going to keep earning the right to have very high returns on capital if you look after all your stakeholders. If you deliver high returns at the expense of your customers, your suppliers, your employees, the environment, or the society more broadly, you'll get found out. You'll get found out by social media. You'll get found out by asset owners and focus there is today in global markets. So we've always felt our search for future quality and the search for high ESG attributes are absolutely the same thing.
So we have more than 60 elections coming up around the world, and we've got US, we have India, we have the UK, we have Indonesia, and obviously European Parliament. Do you think this is going to impact your investing in any way, or is it something you've already sort of factored into your global approach?
Well, factoring in would suggest we've got amazing predictive power in terms of the red and blue debate in the United States or indeed elsewhere. And I think we'd be liars. And I think our own experience, having been through things such as Brexit and so on, trying to predict such events is not an easy one.
Very true.
I would suggest being observers around about politics, because it can have significant change. But by its very nature of politics, not always predictable. So I think we wait and watch. More often than not, it means very little. Great companies flourish irrespective of the politics. But sometimes politics can change ways to make that more difficult. If it happens, we'll address it with that new information when it comes along.
And were you given a great piece of advice when you started your career? And what was it? And have you lived by it?
Oh, there's a good question. I'm not sure what the advice that brought me into this industry was particularly clear, given I didn't know what I was going to do. I did a degree in geology where most people were losing the jobs, never mind employing. So I randomly found my way into being the first graduate trainee at a company called Dunedin Fan Managers in Edinburgh, and the first person they'd ever interviewed. So in terms of the advice of what to say or ask, when neither side knew what to do in terms of the questions to ask or how I answered them. But so I'm not sure what I would particularly highlight. So maybe I'll come back to you on that.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I've really appreciated your time. And thank you very much for being one of our managers.
Absolutely delighted. And I think it's in a great cause.
And a safe trip home.
Okay, thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please join the Future Generation family, Australia's first listed investment companies to provide investment and social returns. We are proud to have given more than $75 million to Australian not-for-profits. You can be part of this and gain investment returns while contributing to improve the lives of young Australians. For more information about Future Generation, please visit our website, www.futuregeninvest.com.au. Thank you.